Peter B. Collins News and Comment. Here it is, Tuesday, April 23rd, 2013. One of my favorite folkies from the 60s has passed away, Richie Havens.
Little darling, it's been a long, long, lonely winter. Little darling, it seems like years since it's been here. Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. And I say, it's all right.
We'll talk more about Richie Havens and play another one of my favorite Richie Havens songs right at the end of this podcast. Update from Boston and the bedside interrogation of the surviving suspect in the Boston Marathon bombing that occurred a week ago Monday. And let me stress that what I'm about to recite to you is all coming from unnamed official sources. And who knows how accurate this might be. But according to those sources, the 19-year-old Jokhar Tsarnaev has said that, and apparently all of this is done through written statements or nods of the head, because he is unable to speak. He apparently was able to say the word no when he was asked if he had enough money for a lawyer. So we are told that he has somehow conveyed to his interrogators that the American wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were what motivated him and his brother to carry out this attack. So that suggests blowback of some sort. The official sources are really underscoring the official belief that these two men self-radicalized through internet sites and reacting to U.S. actions in the Muslim world. And Jokhar has specifically cited the war in Iraq as and the war in Afghanistan as irritants or provocations, I suppose, to him and his brother. Now, he has provided limited information to authorities that indicate that he and his brother acted independently without direction or significant influence from Islamist militants overseas. U.S. officials said they're still working to assemble a detailed timeline of a trip that the older brother took to Russia, but they see no evidence that he received instructions that were that perhaps led to the attack. So, again, I'm reciting to you this official information, and it does conflict with the observations of many people who know much more than I do about Chechnya, about the Caucasus, about Dagestan. And I'm going to put up a link to two different sources that I would like you to explore. One is my friend and colleague Sibel Edmonds in a lengthy interview with James Corbett, the Canadian who is based in Japan, who is a regular contributor to Boiling Frog's Post. He and Sibel completed a series of interviews recently about the history of U.S. involvement on a covert basis in the Caucasus region. And it's called Gladio. Too much there to recap for you here, but do explore that if you have the time and interest. Sibel has been looking at these issues for more than 10 years, since her work as a translator at the FBI exposed her to the underbelly of covert U.S. operations in the region. And both she and Colleen Rowley, whose article at consortiumnews.com I will also link to in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com. Colleen Rowley, in an article that was published really shortly after these two men were identified as the prime suspects, she points out the connection of neocons to the rebels, the liberation movements in Chechnya, as a way to counter the power of Vladimir Putin in Russia. And so there is quite a backstory here, a lot of interesting history so far, and Sibel is very clear about this. She separates her knowledge and her speculation. And so I find her very credible on this, as I always do, but I you know, look at her skeptically just like I do any other source. And I think that she offers some very powerful background information. And when you heard Rudolph Giuliani, for example, the former New York City mayor and failed presidential candidate, pipe up, well, he is not an innocent bystander when it comes to the covert war that has been underway in Chechnya for a long time now. So take a look at that, absorb the information. We're still waiting for a lot more evidence to surface. And as I say, I think we all need to remain skeptical about the official story, about the way the corporate media passes, usually without question or challenge, the information fed to it by the government in a case like this. Also, there is no update on the so-called sleeper cell, up to 12 individuals who they thought were aligned with the Tsarnaev brothers. Nothing new on that that I have seen so far today. The most remarkable thing, though, that I picked up in the last 24 hours was the press conference hosted by Jay Carney at the White House. He is the press secretary. And all of this revolved around the shrill calls from right-wingers, Peter King, Lindsey Graham, Senator Chambliss from Georgia, that they should treat the surviving Tsarnaev brother as an enemy combatant, not read him his rights, subject him to harsh interrogation. And then, as I heard one neocon on the PBS NewsHour on Monday night say, yeah, then we can put him back in the court system just like we did with Padilla. Well, I have been highly critical of the Obama administration on so many fronts. But this is a very strong move. It's the right move to read him his rights, get him lawyered up. I know that's not popular. And to move forward with a criminal prosecution. Now, what's remarkable about what Jay Carney said is that he cannot be tried in a military commission under federal law because he is a U.S. citizen. Quote, "We will prosecute this terrorist through our civilian system of justice." Now, when I heard him say that, I said, "Hey, Jay," I screamed right at the TV, "what about your NDAA? The White House fought so hard for that provision in the Defense Authorization Act for 2012, and we've been over this a zillion times. Section 1021B allows them to detain someone in the United States, a citizen or otherwise, and Tsarnaev is a citizen, indefinitely, without charge, without trial, and potentially at a military base. That is the law. I hate that law. I object to it. I think it's unconstitutional. But the Obama administration went to great lengths, as we have reported here, after Judge Catherine Forrest imposed a permanent injunction on this detention clause of the law. The Obama Justice Department rolled over on that within a week and found an appeals court to put a stay on the permanent injunction, and now that's all tied up in court. But the bottom line is that the NDAA is active. It is the law of the land, as odious as it is. And this would have been the perfect opportunity to quiet the critics and to do a test drive on the NDAA with a case where the media narrative and the circumstantial evidence just shows this guy to be a dark, evil person who wanted to kill people, innocent people at the Boston Marathon. And certainly there would have been plenty of public support for that. I have an email into Carl Mayer, the attorney who has challenged the NDAA detention law, and I'll report to you his comments when I receive them. Also, I wanted to mention an important court ruling came out on April 22nd in Oakland here in California from Federal District Judge Phyllis Hamilton. And this is a long-running case related to the School of the Americas, the Torture Academy at Fort Benning, Georgia, which has a different name now. It's the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation. But it's the SOA to me, and the SOA watch led by a courageous former Catholic priest, he was defrocked, Father Roy Bourgeois, they filed suit because they had collected the names and all the details of all the people who had attended the School of Americas, and they released that information back in 2004. Then the Pentagon moved to block any further disclosure of either students or teachers at the renamed School of the Americas. And the court has ruled that they can't do that. She has ordered that access to who trains and teaches at the school be restored. So we'll see what moves are made to retain the secrecy there. I wouldn't be surprised if Obamaco fights hard again on this one. In an in-depth interview released for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, we talk with Professor Gar Alperovitz. And he's a fascinating guy who has worked in government, was a staffer on Capitol Hill. He's got a whole range of experience. And in his new book, he talks about the current economic inequities. And he is remarkably optimistic about his vision for change to a new economic order that doesn't attack the middle class or serve us up as the seed crop, if you will. So here's an excerpt from my conversation with the professor where he talks about the positive impact of the Occupy movement on America's economic sensibilities.
Well, I think the Occupy was extremely important, and it exploded the myth that everyone was going to go along with the game. And I think that's a very important thing. Also, I've been traveling around the country and with this book tour, and one of the things that I've discovered is Occupy has had a very powerful impact in quite another way. And here's how you think about it, and I hadn't quite realized this until very recently. Before the Occupy movement occurred, lots of young people were doing their thing. They were going to college or trying to find a job or whatever. They were isolated politically. They didn't think of themselves as political activists. They didn't think of themselves as part of a movement. What Occupy did is it shattered that, and it brought people together temporarily in an action that was a political action. They discovered that maybe they could do something. Much more important, they met people. And if you look around the country, and they met people who shared their view and who were support groups. So if you look around the country, and as I say, I've been traveling around a lot, and I write about it in What Then Must We Do, you will find thousands of projects on the ground. Some of them are agricultural. Some of them worker co-ops. Some of them have to do with food and developing different patterns of ownership of agriculture. Some of them have to do with energy. Many, many different projects. And behind the projects are small groups of people who met each other in the Occupy movement. So if you look at it sociologically, Occupy has both crystallized an idea that we've got to do something, and although you don't see big explosions, if you look below the surface, you'll find small groups of people. In fact, a couple of them drove me here today from Madison to Milwaukee, who found each other in the Occupy movement, and then they're beginning to try, in this particular case, to set up a complex of co-ops in Madison. And I think you're going to see more and more of that around the country in a way that will... is hard to report on, it's hard to see, but it is a sociological and cultural result of that explosion, and that has not disappeared, but indeed is ongoing. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
You can hear the full interview with Professor Gar Alperovitz. It's available today for subscribers at peterbcollins.com. If you haven't signed up already, I wish you would. You get a 24-hour pass for just $1. It's $5 a month, or our best deal, $50 a year. And I still have a few copies left for new annual subscribers of Sibel Edmonds' powerful book, Classified Woman. I'd love to send you a copy. If you want to take out a subscription, go to peterbcollins.com, and under my picture on the left-hand side, just follow the links. It just takes a couple of minutes. Great news coming from the Big Sky State of Montana. Max Baucus, after 36 years in the United States Senate, is throwing in the towel. He had planned to run for re-election next year. He got bruised badly over his Republican vote on the failed watered-down gun control legislation in the U.S. Senate recently, and he has decided that he's had enough. He had $5 million in his campaign account, and as we reported, he's been greased by lobbyists, 28 different ones who work for bank and other economic interests, because he chairs the Senate Finance Committee. And those 28 people all used to work for Max Baucus. And the incest of that arrangement is something that will retire with him, and I couldn't be happier. Speculation in Montana is that former Governor Brian Schweitzer, who just left office in January, is the leading Democrat most likely to take the place of Max Baucus. I find Brian Schweitzer very bright. He's a very clever politician. He is engaging and very articulate. He is a Montanan. He's big into promoting of shale oil and other polluting extraction of energy. And I believe that he is as pro-gun as Max Baucus. But he doesn't owe his soul to all of those contributors who plied the Baucus campaign with cash over the years, and so we can hope for some change there. But also that it's likely that the seat will remain Democratic, because there are quite a few senators retiring in the next cycle, and it leaves the control of the Senate up for grabs, really. Well, there was a lot of attention paid briefly last week to the mailing of letters alleged to contain ricin to President Obama and a couple of members of the U.S. Senate. And the man who was fingered on that has been released from jail in Oxford, Mississippi. He is a current or former Elvis impersonator named Paul Curtis. He's been released on bond, but they say charges have not been dropped. The release follows an FBI agent's testimony on Monday that investigators have not found ricin or ingredients for making it, either at his house or in his car. And so that was a case that seemed to be solved and now is once again in the unclear column. Over at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, the hunger strikes continue. And finally, the corporate media, the mainstream media in this country, is starting to pay more attention. I give credit to Ray Suarez for a great report on the PBS NewsHour last night with a journalist from the Miami Herald, and he really did a good recap of the situation. I'll resist the the temptation to slam them for waiting so long, but maybe the corporate media will follow PBS into covering this very important issue. And for up-to-date coverage and some of the recent history on it, I'll put up a link at peterbcollins.com to Jason Leopold's Guantanamo update at truthout.org. Well, I am going to be taking a flight later this week, and in fact, I'll tell you now that you will not get news and comment podcasts Thursday, Friday, or Monday. I'm going to Portland, Oregon for a conference put on by the University of Oregon called What is Radio? And I'm a moderator of one panel and a panelist on another. I'm looking forward to it. But the flight means that I won't be able to bring my small knife with me. Not that it's really important. But the TSA, responding to the hysterical reaction from many, including Democratic legislators, has delayed the relaxation of the rule on small knives, bats, and other sports equipment being carried into the cockpit of an airliner, or into the cabin. It's not the cockpit. The cockpit is sealed off, which is one of the reasons why small knives are no longer the threat they once were. So I'm sorry to see that, but the other thing is I may be delayed on my flight from SFO to Portland because of the sequester influenced furloughs in the air traffic control towers. And this does appear to be a very calculated demonstration of the negative impacts of the sequester and a way to put pressure on Congress to reverse some of those across-the-board cuts, particularly in a critical area like air traffic control. And the furloughs started taking effect yesterday, and from big airports, including LAX, right down to smaller regional fields, there have been delays. And like I say, I think that we are the victims of some calculated political theater. Of course, I think that the airport security is pure and simple political theater. A couple of items, setbacks for my friends who still smoke cigarettes. The Supreme Court ruled on Monday. Actually, they rejected a case, so the lower court decision stands, that the Food and Drug Administration does have the authority to regulate tobacco. And they left in place a ruling that said for the first time that the government can regulate tobacco. Congress had used all kinds of schemes to prevent that in the past, and it allows the challenged rules, including a ban on tobacco companies sponsoring athletic, social, and cultural events or offering free samples or branded merchandise. Meanwhile, in New York City, billionaire Mike Bloomberg has proclaimed that no one younger than 21 will be able to buy cigarettes under a proposal to make New York the most populous place in America to set the minimum age that high. We'll see if that actually goes into effect. In international news, Israel is joining France and Britain in declaring that Syria has recently been using chemical weapons in the ongoing civil war there. The senior military intelligence analyst, Brigadier General Itai Brun, has said that the regime has increasingly used chemical weapons, and the very fact that they have used chemical weapons without any appropriate reaction is a very worrying development. Now, Obama has said that it would change everything if it's discovered that the Bashar al-Assad government has used poison gas, but so far we don't have any actual proof. Even the New York Times in this article concedes none of the assertions by Israel, Britain, or France have been made with physical proof of the use of chemical weapons. An emergency landing by a helicopter carrying foreign engineers in eastern Afghanistan turned into a mass abduction by the Taliban. Due to bad weather, the aircraft was forced to land in Logar province, which is not so far from the capital of Kabul, and 11 people were abducted, including 8 Turkish engineers and 1 Afghan man. Here in the United States, the report that we talked about and broke down for you a few weeks ago from consultants hired by the State Department to grease the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline has hit a significant amount of turbulence because the Environmental Protection Agency has issued a sharply critical assessment of the State Department's environmental impact review of the Keystone XL. And this, at least at minimum, may slow the process down and prevent the expected approval from the Obama administration sometime this summer. EPA has detailed objections regarding greenhouse gas emissions, pipeline safety, and alternate routes. And just maybe, some of them were on the cleanup site of Exxon's big Pegasus pipeline spill in Mayflower, Oklahoma, and said, maybe these pipelines aren't such a great idea. And speaking of energy, the Chevron Corporation, which is based here in the San Francisco Bay Area and has a refinery that remains shut down across the bridge from me in Richmond, has an interesting about-face. Because it was just in 2007 that Chevron helped write the carbon emissions rules here in California that are really the only accomplishment that can be claimed by Republican Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. The oil company at that time pledged to develop a gasoline replacement from wood. Now, Chevron is leading a lobbying and public relations campaign to undercut the California mandate directed at curbing global warming, 2 years after the state started phasing it in. And while their cover story is that we've done everything, we looked at 100 feedstocks, 50 conversion technologies, worked to shape this law the best we can, and we haven't come up with a solution to be able to comply. So after 2 years, Chevron is walking away. Insiders report that the real reason is that they penciled out the potential profits of these alternate fuels, and they only had margins of 10 or 15%. Not nearly obscene enough for a company like Chevron. Finally today, we honor the passing at the age of 72 of Richie Havens, a man with a beautiful voice, a great folk guitar style, mostly known for doing covers of other people's songs.
Got the blues for my baby down by the San Francisco Bay.
I got the chance to meet and interview Richie Havens several times.
Liner took her so far away.
And he presented like a religious figure, flowing robes, lots of jewelry. At one point, he was wearing, I think, about 20 pounds of jade jewelry when I talked to him.
She said goodbye.
Very friendly, unpretentious. And just one of the most beautiful, memorable voices I've ever heard.
Ain't got a nickel and I ain't got a lousy dime.
Thank you, Richie Havens.
And if she don't come back, I guess I'm gonna lose my mind. If she ever comes back to stay, gonna be another brand new day. When I go walking with my baby down by the San Francisco Bay. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Another city, oh Lord, I'm just about to go insane. I thought I heard my baby call the way she used to call my name. If she ever comes back today, gonna be another brand new day. When I go walking with my baby, talking to my baby, clinging to my baby, clinging to my baby. When I go walking with my baby down by the San Francisco Bay.